Hey guys, it's Albert. We got a great show for you this week amid everything that's going on in our country. We'll be talking a lot on Tom Brady and the takeaways. We'll also have a guest to come in to break down the situation with number 12 and the legacy that he leaves in New England. And as we always do, we'll wrap things up with a six-pack of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Obviously, a lot of NFL news this week. I do off the top want to address the situation in our country because we're all in it. You know, we're all sort of in this thing together, and it's a tough time in our country. I just want to give my best to all of you who are out there listening. And I just hope that everybody's doing what they can to contribute to the effort to try to get this thing under control, and we can all do our part. You can stay in your house. You know, you can be careful about your interactions with other people in general, and in particular, you know, older people. You know, we can take care of our parents. And so I just hope that everybody out there is doing everything that they can to help get this thing, you know, under control. I don't know the science behind it. I'm not a doctor. I've talked to doctors about it. I know that there is a complexity to this, you know, an unprecedented nature to this. The fact that we don't have, we don't have a vaccine for it. Like, there's a lot of different reasons why this is such a different situation. But I think we can all do our part here, and hope we're all doing our part to help the powers that be get this thing under control. We do have football this week, and it does feel a little weird. I'm not going to lie. I was one of the people that said that the NFL probably shouldn't go forward with the league year. I have not talked to a single general manager, scout, head coach, assistant coach across the NFL who thinks that it was a good idea to go forward with this. A lot of them thought the league should have taken the lead on this. The league did not take the lead on this. The league has sort of dodged responsibility at this, and based on the way that the league's kind of conducted itself over the last 10 to 15 years, it's very easy to look at this and say the league's just being opportunistic again, seeing that they have the sports stage all to themselves for these few days. That criticism, I think, is fair. You know, it's they've painted themselves that way over the last 10 years. They have to understand when they do something like this, it's going to come off that way, and I think it has come off that way. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting, exciting, different storylines going on in the NFL, and we're going to cover all of those there. We're going to start with the takeaways. We got a great guest for you to talk about the Tom Brady situation, so we'll get into it with him. We've got all your questions coming in the mailbag, but we're going to start with the takeaways, and the number one takeaway, of course, has to be what we've seen happen, transpire over the course of the last, I'd say, 6-7 hours or so on the Tom Brady front. Tom Brady going on social media this morning, basically announcing that he he is finished with the Patriots, that he went on and thanked Bill Belichick, thanked Robert Kraft, thanked the fans. He actually went to Robert Kraft's house in Brookline, Mass. Last night. They discussed it. So the book is now closed on Tom Brady as a Patriot. And I think it's hard for anybody. It's hard for me to really kind of explain. It's hard for me to kind of, I think, illustrate the impact that he's had in the area of the country that I live in. And I live, you know, I live about a half hour outside of Boston. I grew up 20 minutes outside of Boston. Growing up here, the Patriots weren't the biggest deal. In fact, I think for a lot of my childhood, you could argue the Patriots, as far as loyalty goes, fan loyalty goes, were number four. And, you know, the first people that were responsible for changing that really were Drew Bledsoe. And were Drew Bledsoe and Bill Parcells. Robert Kraft bought the team a year after those guys arrived. Everything changed. But, I mean, really the guys who took it to another level and changed the landscape up here forever were Brady and Belichick. You know, I think one's the best quarterback of all time, one's the best coach of all time. And so the impact that he had in the organization, they right now are the seventh most valuable sports franchise on the planet. Okay? That's a franchise where, when I was a kid, there were 20,000 people sitting in metal bleachers in probably the worst stadium in the NFL. It's just a listless franchise. When I was in elementary school, when I was in middle school, at least at the start in middle school before Parcells got there, everybody rooted for different teams. Like, I rooted for the Buffalo Bills when I was a kid because I had a family connection to them. We had a lot of people who rooted for the Dolphins, a lot of people who rooted for the Cowboys, people who rooted for the Niners. Where I grew up, at least, and granted, there were a lot of transplants growing up where I grew up, but the fandom was all over the map. And it wasn't that way with the Red Sox or the Celtics or the Bruins. It wasn't that way in those sports. Those teams were so embedded in the region, and the Patriots were sort of the stepchild. And so to go from that to now being the seventh most valuable sports franchise on the planet, just behind Manchester United, just ahead of the Los Angeles Lakers, there are a lot of people who deserve credit for that. Certainly Robert Kraft, Bill Parcells, Drew Bledsoe. But, I mean, no one more than Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. And so those two guys, certainly, I think, you know, no matter what happens from here going forward, their place is cemented both in NFL history, both in the history of the area that I live in. And so, you know, why did it have to come to this? Well, you know, I think it's pretty simple. To me, the situation here is what it is because you have on one side, a coach who's unrelenting, who's so disciplined about separating his personal relationships and his professional relationships, who's so disciplined about the way he does business with players and has forever kind of held the line with player after player after player. And, you know, I think it's caused them to make some mistakes over the years, but on the whole, you look at it and there's no question that it's worked, right? And then on the other side, you have this player who was so competitive, who was such a good soldier, such a good teammate, such a good employee, such a good player, like he would take all of it. And we're going to get into this with our guest, but he sort of enabled everything. You know, he enabled Belichick to be tough on everybody because the second string tackle sitting in the third row of the auditorium during the Wednesday morning meeting sees Tom Brady getting chewed out, and he's not going to have any space to say anything. And so he enabled him that way. He enabled him by taking less in his contracts. He was such a huge part, and Belichick acknowledged this in his statement, such a huge part of building that culture. And so if the coach, Belichick, is going to adhere to the culture that he's built, then he's got to continue to look, this is a belief thing, got to continue to hold the line on all players, including the greatest player of all time. I think eventually it just got to the point where, you know, Brady's earned the chance to go somewhere else and to have a different feeling around him, have a different vibe around him, have maybe a little more control over the offense, like work in a different environment, all of that. And so, yeah, I think what you have here is just on one side, the tough, unrelenting, disciplined leader of the program. And on the other side, you have a guy who enabled it forever, but it's just gotten worn down by being in it. And so now he'll go and find a new home. As for where he winds up, you know, we've talked about Tampa, we've talked about the Chargers. I still think those are the two teams that are most enthusiastically in it. And the both those teams have their merits. Both have young offensive coordinators, Byron Leftwich in Tampa, Shane Steichen in L.A. Both those guys have ability, but both those guys are also probably going to be flexible in how they build an offense. Both those teams have offensive skill talent, which is an important thing. In Tampa, it's Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, O.J. Howard, Cam Brate, Ronald Jones, who came around a little bit late in the year. In L.A., it's Hunter Henry, it's Keenan Allen, it's Mike Williams, it's Austin Eckler. The Chargers have some work to do on the offensive line. The Bucs are pretty good in that area. You know, both teams have a bunch of stuff going for them. The Bucs have the proximity to New York where Brady's going to have family rooted. So there are moving parts there. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But today, I think, was a day to kind of reflect on what he was able to accomplish in New England. And obviously, it's historic. I can just tell you from my own interactions with the guy, I think he was ready for this. I don't think that the idea of finishing his career with the Patriots is ever anything he saw as automatic. Maybe it's a little shocking to him now, but I can remember conversations I had with him where it was clear that, you know, he was prepared for the possibility that he was going to wind up, you know, like his good friend Lawyer Malloy in 2003, who was dumped unceremoniously before the season opener. He'd been a captain on the Super Bowl team a couple of years earlier. He's seen it up close. I think, you know, his boyhood idol, Joe Montana, was traded out of San Francisco. Yeah, I think that's something he's prepared for. Of course, I think the finality of this morning was just kind of hit all of us in a different way. Takeaway number two, look, the DeAndre Hopkins situation in Houston is another sign to me of how all in the Texans are on Bill O'Brien. And the reason why is because I think a lot of that not working there came down to how O'Brien values players. They weren't willing to give him a new contract. And also sort of how Bill O'Brien runs his program and how he envisions the program setting up. And I think so much of this, there's a personality conflict between player and coach. So that was there. But I also think there's the whole way that Hopkins sort of went about his business. And we talked about how Brady enabled, you know, the Patriots program. Like, Hopkins had his own way of getting ready. And Hopkins wasn't, you know, always like there was a way that practice was managed with him and all of that different stuff. And I think that sort of thing probably wore on O'Brien a little bit, wore on the Texans a little bit. That's not saying Hopkins did anything wrong, because clearly, I mean, three-time first-team All-Pro the last 3 years, right? Like, so one of the best receivers, if not the best receiver in football. But there's no question that there was conflict personality-wise. There was conflict philosophically there, and I think that's what led to the trade. My problem with the trade is not being able to get more for him, and that they weren't able to do more to capitalize on what they had from an asset standpoint. And, you know, DeAndre Hopkins is worth more than a second round pick to me. Maybe the fact that he had, you know, high hopes for a new contract played into the market. And certainly I don't think it was any secret across the league that teams had called on DeAndre Hopkins over the last couple of years, because word had gotten out on this. But I still think that you have to be able to get more than a second round pick for him. Takeaway number three. The Buffalo Bills trade for Stephon Diggs. And to me, this is an interesting story about how quickly things can happen in the NFL. And I want to take you guys through this to kind of give you an illustration of how this stuff works. Okay, so on Monday morning, Kirk Cousins agrees to a 2-year extension to stay in Minnesota as the starting quarterback. It wasn't long after that. And look, my understanding of the situation there that is there's a little bit of a, I guess, jealousy, and I think Thielen and Diggs got along fine. But there's a little bit of a feeling from Diggs that Cousins looked to Thielen in tight spots, looked to Thielen when it really counted. And that caused some issue between Cousins and Diggs. And so it was an open secret that there were, you know, issues over time between Diggs and Cousins. So it was interesting to see Diggs then tweeting that it was time for a new start just after Cousins got a new contract. So what does that do? Well, that causes teams to pick up the phone, and teams had called the Vikings on Cousins over the course of the last year or so, most notably before the trade deadline. They'd gotten calls in the, over the course of February, there've been interest in Diggs. And so, you know, the Vikings on the fly, they start getting calls, you know, in the afternoon, late afternoon Buffalo calls. And what the Vikings did was they said, okay, we're going to set a price and we're going to see if we can get our price. Their price was the Percy Harvin trade, which was a first round pick. And it's kind of a combination of lower round picks. They wound up with a 3. In this case, they didn't wind up with a 3, but they came pretty close to getting their price there. And so, you know, basically the Patriots were in it. Obviously the Bills were in it. You know, I'd heard the Eagles had some interest. The Redskins really liked the idea of Diggs, but they have the second overall pick. They weren't going to trade that, and they don't have a second rounder. So logistically, it was difficult for them. And the Bills sort of stayed in touch with the Vikings over the course of the afternoon. And then at 9:45, there's a phone call, and, you know, they start getting serious. A half hour later, it's done. So in that short period of time, it got done really, really fast. I think the Vikings got good value for Diggs, and given what there's going to be available in the draft, they could wind up with somebody like a CeeDee Lamb or a Jerry Jeudy. They've got a ton of capital now, and this will allow them to bring in a guy who's going to be cheaper and a cost control asset for the next few years at a time when they do have a little bit of a salary cap issue. So it makes sense to the Vikings for that. And look, with the Bills, their mandate going into this year, score points. Their mandate going into the offseason, score points. Find a way to get guys who are going to generate points. They've got a lot of good complementary weapons on their offense. Dawson Knox is a promising young tight end. You got the two free agent receivers they brought in last year, Cole Beasley and John Brown. Singletary looks like he's going to be a good back. They've got some pieces on the offensive line. What they really needed was a focal point that would sort of be the centerpiece with all those complementary pieces around it, and that's what Diggs can be. Takeaway number four, the DeForest Buckner deal. Again, I'm going to sound like I'm towing lines here and everything else, but I think the DeForest Buckner deal was a legitimate win-win for both teams. for the Niners, they had to decide what they were going to do on the defensive line. And they had two guys. Nick Bosa is going to be there long term. He's going to get paid eventually. You know, they've already paid D Ford. And so they had these two guys coming to the end of their rookie deals, former first round picks or former top 10 picks, and DeForest Buckner and Eric Armstead. And the idea was, how can we maximize those two? And they knew they probably weren't going to be able to keep both of them. At one point, there was this idea that was floated around the organization. Let's look at the idea of tagging and trading Armstead, like the Chiefs did D Ford last year, like the Seahawks did Frank Clark last year. Let's see if we can do that. I think what they found was there was more value around the league in DeForest Buckner than there was in Eric Armstead, who broke out last year. So what do? They look at the kind of bigger picture of the whole thing, and they figure out, okay, we can get more for Buckner than we can for Armstead. We can keep Armstead for a little bit cheaper. He wound up getting $3 million less per year than Buckner got, and we can get a first-round pick out of this. Let's look at that. And so that's how they sort of wound up there. They wound up keeping Armstead long-term, allows them to keep Jimmy Ward long-term, was another big piece of their defense. And now they'll bring in a potential, with that first-round pick, like they could get a receiver, they could wind up with an offensive lineman. There are a lot of different things they could do with their first-round pick. And so, you know, I think it's sort of another example of how the Niners look at everything globally, and it's not just what you do with one player. It's like what you make of the assets that you have. Finally, takeaway number five, the Panthers announced on Tuesday that they are allowing Cam Newton to go and seek a trade. Certainly sounds like from what we've heard. I mean, if you read David Tepper's statement, it's sort of right there. They're not planning on having Cam Newton back next year. So even if they couldn't find a trade partner, possibility they wind up cutting him. And they agreed to terms with Teddy Bridgewater, 3 years, $60 million. Teddy Bridgewater has background with their new offensive coordinator, Joe Brady, who was a quality control assistant in New Orleans 2 years ago with Bridgewater there as the backup quarterback. So this makes sense from a couple different standpoints. Number one, do I think Teddy's a better player than Cam? Probably not. But if you look at Cam's situation, was he going to be willing to come back in a contract year with no assurance of anything going forward as a new coach tried to establish his program? That's tough. And if you're a new coach looking to sort of build something where everybody's going to be on board, like if you've got a guy who has that sort of power within the organization, who may not be all that happy that he hasn't been extended, who's wondering about his future constantly, is that the sort of thing you want lingering around there in a year where you may not be really very good anyway? I think the easier thing for the Panthers to do was look at it and say, well, we're better off just having everybody on board here. And we're better off having people in the position group rooms who are bought into what we're trying to do. And even if it means we're not as good this year, what's that going to be the difference between 7-9 and 5-11, 6-10 and 4-12? I mean, isn't it more important to be able to sort of establish something and hit the ground running going into 2021? So I think that's sort of the idea there. And to me, I just don't know that Cam Newton would have been on board with what Rhule was going to be selling if he has his own future to worry about. And so you have some moving parts there, but you lose Cam, you bring in Teddy, who again can sort of be a teacher of what Joe Brady's trying to do in the building. He gets a chance to, you know, entrench himself as a starting quarterback somewhere. And Matt Rhule gets, again, a locker room that's going to be a little bit more fully on board because you are bringing in new guys who are choosing to be there. Finally, before we get to our special guest, the CBA was done. I don't want to bore you guys with the details. We've talked enough about it on the podcast over the course of the last few weeks. Here's the one thing I would say. The reason there's a divide between the star players and the rank and file, one group of players and another group of players, the CBA, I don't think, is a bad deal. I think there's merit in what they're doing. If the goal was, let's just keep getting rich, then this deal works. This deal will do that. This deal will make money for the players. It's better than the 2011 CBA, if you look at the numbers. So from that standpoint, it's a good deal. There were players out there that felt like giving the owners what they wanted and getting this thing done quickly so they get the broadcast deals and going to 17 games, have those two elements, meant they had to get something big back and that this was a chance to get a game-changing deal. And this isn't a game changer. This deal isn't. It's sort of a continuation of the old CBA with some improvements and a few drawbacks. And so, again, a good deal, a game changer, no. And I think, you know, the players that are sort of just kind of happy to go forward with what they have and capitalize on how the NFL is going to be making money off the broadcast networks and eventually gambling, for those players that wanted that, this gives them that. For the players that were looking for a game-changing type of deal, that's not what this is. All right, let's get to our guest. All right, well, obviously everybody's still digesting the Tom Brady news, and so I wanted to get someone in who's got a close relationship with him, who knows him, and I couldn't think of too many people I know better than the guy who I cope. I don't want to be crass about this, but the guy who he kind of had his hands in a certain region of yours for what, like 8-9 years. So
I mean, you know, it is what it is. That's the truth.
Yeah, so that's former Patriots and Broncos center Dan Cope, and also now a brewer, an entrepreneur. We can talk a little bit about that at the end. But Cope, I here's where I want to start. I guess just your initial reaction, how you got the news this morning, who told you, or how you saw it, or and then just sort of how you digested it as somebody who knows him so well.
You know, I got up this morning and going through Twitter or something like that, just basically checking the news. You know, I have a Twitter account and I don't post a lot, but I do use it for my news. And I think I saw, Schefter's, report where, you know, I think what Tom Brady says goodbye to Patriots on social media. So obviously that catches your eye and, a little bit of shock, you know, disappointment, weirdness. Then you go online and, you know, you sort of see the whole picture and, you know, what he said in this post. And, it's going to be odd. There's no doubt about it. 20 years with one franchise. It's going to be weird to see him in a different, uniform next year. So I think I'm pretty much, you know, I've been out for so long now. I'm where everybody else is. I'm a fan, whether you're a fan of New England or not, you know, it's still going to be weird to see him in a different outfit or a different uniform.
Okay, so like before we get into like kind of his mindset, like you went through this yourself. Like you spent most of your career in New England, and you know, there came a point when, you know, you moved on and you wound up going and finishing your career in Denver. Like what's that process like for an athlete? Like when you've accomplished a lot in one place, you know, you won championships with Tom in New England. Like what was that process like?
It's tough, you know, and then everybody says it from, you know, basically the first day that you get into the league or professional sports, whatever particular sport that you play with, it's hard to start your career in one place and end it with that same organization, regardless of how it goes. Whether you're traded, whether you're cut, whether you, you know, decide to leave. You know, his situation was, you know, probably from what I'm reading now, he, you know, this is probably his decision. He could have went back to the Patriots, but he felt it was in the best interest of himself and his family, which, hey, 20 years into that, into the league, you know, you're low 40s age-wise, you know, you've earned that right. So, you know, this is what he feels best. So you got to respect that, but it's just weird because I was cut, so I didn't have a choice. You know, he had a choice, and that's what it is. But going to a different organization, there's good things that go along with it. I said this to someone today, and, you know, Bert cut me off. I don't want to ramble or whatever, but I said this today. I played for Bill for 9 years, and for 9 years, he told us at the end of the season, he's a tough coach to play for. And after 9 years, I was mentally and, you know, physically exhausted of playing for that guy. And me going to Denver sort of recharged my batteries. Now, I'm not saying that Tom's deal and he's so sick of Bill, that's why he's going on. But I can imagine 11 more years that he played for that guy is very demanding. So whether he looks at it as a new organization, as a new opportunity, a way to recharge and, you know, really go back to the love of football, I don't know. But, you know, I can tell you that he's going to use this as a motivating factor, as he's done for other things that have happened to himself.
What was tangibly different then for you? Like when you went somewhere else and you'd been in a like such a demanding program for so long and obviously had a lot of success for there, like you said, to recharge your batteries, what was like tangibly different when you left?
Yeah, football in New England, one is about winning. There's no doubt about it. And sometimes it's not fun in New England, but winning is always fun and it makes it worth it. Whether that is, oh, you can have a conversation with your coach or, you know, just the feeling from day to day in the organization. And I'm not putting New England down whatsoever. I loved every moment that I had there. But after a while, that environment is mentally taxing on you. I've had conversations with Bill on or in that facility and off the outside of the facility. It's almost like two completely different people, which is great where he can sort of separate it a little bit. But man, just for me going into Denver, you're sitting at the breakfast table with John Fox and he's telling stories to everybody. It's just a different feeling and maybe a different way of doing things. Not that one way is better than the other. You can win different ways. You can have different environments and different feelings in that locker room. It's about what you do on the football field and the talent pool that you have on your team. So we were able to win in both spots. So you can have both ways. You know, you can have fun with it or you can grind it out. That's just the way it is. And that's sort of what, New England has sort of gotten that stigma over the last 20 years.
Okay. So you were like, you got to see Tom as a young player. So, and I think what he would have been probably 25, 26 when you were drafted, somewhere in there, right? And you got to see him. You got to see him from going from he'd won one championship, but I guess there were probably still some questions.
He was already a star, but he went to basically a David Beckham star during that time. Yeah,
right. So what sort of difference maker was he like day to day in that organization? I mean, like I said, like you saw it not from the ground floor, but you were local. I mean, you went to BC, so you were local while he won his first championship. And obviously now you get to see it on a more intimate level starting in 2003, like on a day to day basis, what sort of difference maker was Tom for that organization, for what Bill Belichick was trying to do, for all of it?
No, huge. I mean, I think I think they do a great job with their organization. Number one in New England with, Mr. Kraft sitting up top and making decisions, but, really staying away from the football decisions. Like, it's management style. Like, this guy does this the best. I'm going to let him do this. I do this the best. I'll do this. And sort of delegating power where he feels that he needs to do that. And he did a great job. And, obviously Bill has total control. But just saying, when you have the greatest football player that's ever played this game buying into your system and your philosophy for 20 years with really no questions, no media criticisms, always that guy on the same page, saying the right thing, doing the right thing. I don't think you could really ask anything more, for an organization. Have the best player ever just towing the line and just doing what is asked of him, doing what is what he's supposed to do. I don't see that anywhere else happening in any sport, really. He was one of the guys and he took the criticism, he took the coaching, he took blame for losses, which necessarily probably some of those losses aren't on him, but he was that team guy and that's just the way he is. And it was never about the money. It was always about winning with him. And it fit perfectly with Bill for those 20 years.
It like sort of enables it, right? Like, cause you talked about how demanding it was. Well, if the quarterback's willing to get, and let's call it what it is, MF'd in the meeting room, right? Or like that. Yeah. I mean, so that enables everything, right?
Yeah. And that showed, hey, the younger guys, you can't say anything because number 12 is getting bitched at the most. It does enable it. It does to an extent, but they put themselves in that position. Brady wanted to be in this position. He could have probably put himself in that position earlier if he wanted to. And and I said this again today too, football players, sports people, owners, I'll believe they have short-term memory. So once a decision's made, and this decision could have been made 8 years ago, let's just put a number on 8 years ago, the moment that decision's made, those guys have already moved on. Tom's already trying to figure out where he's going to play next, how is he going to get better, how is he going to help that team. Bill's already forgot about the past, and now he's moved on to 2020, and how do we make this team the best to be competitive on the field right now? It's amazing how they move on so well.
How quickly did you realize how special a player Tom was? Like from when you walked into the building, and that would have been like what, May of 2003, right? From the time he and I know obviously you know who he is. You know, you walk in, he's the quarterback. He's won a Super Bowl MVP, all of that.
I was saying, they're gonna lose to the Raiders. They're gonna lose to the Rams, and then sure enough, they pull it off. And then you walk in, you know, you see him, and just like, you know, I don't know about you yet. And then you just talk to him, and it's like, God damn, you're a great guy. You know, you want to hate him even more.
Was it like how long did it take you to realize how special a player he was? Like, and I know there's probably a difference for you seeing it on TV versus, you know, now all of a sudden in 03, you get to see it up close. Was there something from, you know, your first mini camp with him, your first training camp with him, your maybe somewhere in a game, like, was there a point when you realized how he was different?
No, it doesn't take long. You really see it from the moment you walk in, how he welcomes everybody into that life, what he expects out of everybody when you come into that locker room, when you go into the weight room, when you go onto that practice field. You know, I mean, you would think a guy, you know, 10, 15 years in, oh, he's not going to work as hard. He outworks everybody. He knows more than everybody, studies more than everybody. So you really get a sense of who he is and what player he is and how much he puts into it early on to, all right, this guy's different. He's special. You know, they can compare him to, not compare him, but just my time with Denver with Peyton, the same way. You know, you know why these guys are that good? Because they work for it, and they put in the work, and they keep working. No matter how good they get, or we think they get, they think they can get better.
So did you have you mentioned how, like, you all of a sudden you meet him. Did you have like your, like, hi, I'm Tom moment? It seems like everybody does. Like, yeah, I know who you are, dude. Like when you first got there.
I like to think I didn't have the, you know, I heard Andrew's ones, or I like to think I didn't have it, because I think he was only 3 or 4 years in the league at that point. I mean, I knew who he was. He didn't know who I was. And it was, you know, we sort of clicked from the start, but I can tell you right now, I can get where those guys are coming from. If wherever team he's going, if they got a young center, and I'm just going to look back and be like, oh, that's number 12 behind me, you know, I might crap my pants too.
What was it like being in a huddle, being in the huddle in a big game with him? Like, you know, in Super Bowls, championship games, what was it like being in the huddle in a big game or in a big moment with Tom?
It was great. You know, I mean, you have Joe Cool, Montana, and all the stories that they have. It's the same way with Tom. There was never a moment that we thought we weren't out of the game, or we couldn't come back, or we weren't in a great position to win a football game. And his demeanor in the huddle always showed that. It was very rarely did he get, I mean, you see his emotions on the sideline, and he's a fiery guy. You see it on the practice field. But in the huddle, when we were working, it was, his eyes were focused, and, you know, we were all confident that we could get the job done.
Do you, you know, there's the Joe Montana moment where he points to John Candy in the stands. Was there anything like that?
You know, I mean, the one that I can recall, we were playing Buffalo. It was at home. We were down, I think, by 2 scores. I don't remember the year, but we were in the huddle. We were down. It was late in the fourth quarter, and I swear to God, he came in. We had the ball. He came in and said, all right, here's what's going to happen. We're going to score. We're going to get the ball back, and then we're going to score again, or something like that. So we went down. We ended up scoring. Buffalo fumbled, I think, the kickoff. We ended up getting the ball back, and we scored right away within like 2, 3, 4 minutes, whatever it was, and we won the game. We just came off the sideline. me, Light, but Mankins, you know, just came over and just, holy crap, it was exactly, you know, how how he said it was. And obviously he didn't know, but that's the calmness and the confidence that he showed in the huddle to give that to everybody else, the leader that he was. So it was actually one of those moments like, God, can you believe this? And, you know, he predicted it again or something like that. But it was like, when you come back, it's just like, that's what a leader needs to do. That's what you need from a quarterback. Just like, all right, don't worry about what happened now. Here's what's going to happen going forward.
I think that was actually his first game back from the ACL, right?
Was it?
I think it might have been. Yeah, was it a Monday night? Like maybe the first game back from his ACL.
Yeah, it was. I think it may have been opening night. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
it happened exactly how he said. It was just like, oh, all right, you're right.
Obviously, like age-wise, you're right. You guys are right in the same like range. You're like, you're a little younger, but you're right in that range. Have you been surprised by how long he's been able to keep going? Like that he's still going? And I know he's talked about it a lot. Like I can play till I'm 45. But are you surprised that he's actually made it this far?
You know, I think, you know, he started talking about it a long time ago, how he was playing in his 40s. And I think in the beginning, it was sort of like, no way, no, you're not. And it's not necessarily the physical stance or the physical side of it that you can't play that long, because you see how hard he works and he trains. You know, we go down to the Derby or go on trips, and he's the one getting up in the morning and working out. So you saw what care he took of his body, really from, I don't know, probably late 2000s on. So, you know, he has done a great job physically, even though he's, you know, can't really run anymore. He's a pocket passer. But I think it was more like, maybe quarterbacks are different or whatever. It's just like, I don't know how you can play for 20 years. But then, you know, you see him playing 15, 16, 17, and how he's playing. It's just like, he just loves the game of football. And you got to respect someone that just like, hey, I'm a football player. This is what I'm here to do. This is what I love to do. And I'm going to do it. And to see him go out there at 42 years old now, it's just incredible. God bless him. I love, play till you're 50 if you can do it. If he loves the game that much, it's good for everybody to see.
Did you say that he worked out during the Derby weekend?
I'm not going to confirm nor deny that, but I just will say that if someone was in a gym in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, early in the morning on Derby Day, it may have been him.
That's bananas. All right. So
he really does. He cares and he puts in the work. So God bless him.
Yeah. So for you watching him going forward now, do you, I don't know, like how interested are you in seeing where he goes next? You know, cause obviously we've all only seen him in one uniform, but you got a relationship with the guy. And
I'm interested, you know, with everything going on now, and, you know, this pales in comparison to what this country's going through and what this world's going through right now, and we'll get through it. I'm interested. I want to know, you know, it seems like it's going to be Tampa Bay or LA right now. And it's going to be really weird to see him in a different uniform. But, you know, I root for the Patriots. But I'm going to root for that team because I love that guy and I'll follow him anywhere.
All right. So why does everybody say that about him? Like, and I know that sounds like a simple question, but like, yeah, I've been around him, but what makes it, like, for every teammate that, like, would, you know, it feels like every teammate walked to the end of the earth for him. Like, why is that?
You know, football is one thing, and you see how hard he works. So you respect the guy on the field, but if you get to know him off the field, he's, you know, it's a cliche, but he's even a better human. You know, he's a better friend. He honestly cares about your family. He cares how you're doing. And to see somebody that, you know, is just really honest and, hey, I'm me. This is who I am all the time. It doesn't matter, like, how big of a star he is. It doesn't change our relationship. It doesn't change relationships with other friends. It's the same all the time. And you know, what I give him, he gives me back. It's just pretty cool. You know, God, hey, look, I'm from Pennsylvania. You know, I live in Rhode Island now, and you know, he's just on a level way beyond anybody could ever imagine. See him just being a normal dude. It's pretty cool.
Okay. Last thing Brady wise for me then, and I'll put you on the spot here. What's the best Tom Brady story you can tell me that you can tell me here?
Well, I don't know if I can tell. You know the beer chugging. I mean, you know the beer chugging stories. That's true. I mean, the guy can chug a beer. It's pretty impressive, and it really doesn't have to practice all that much. It just sort of happens. That's pretty cool. I'd like to tell you one. I don't know if it's time or place. We'll do this off air, Bert.
Okay. Well, do you have like? Were you there for the story in Buffalo? I think it was when everybody that might have been past your time. Were you there for that one where the team got like stuck in Buffalo or whatever, and like he wound up?
No, we went in New York.
Was it New York?
Well, we got stuck in Buffalo. We had to drive back.
Okay.
We had to drive back from Buffalo. Well, here's all right. So we were at the other one is New York. So we went down and played the Jets. I think it was a Sunday night game or evening game, and then we ended up going to the airport to get back. Well, it was bad weather, so we were sitting on the plane. We're like, oh, okay, the buses will be here. Oh shit! Vrabel was on the team too, but it was we were on the plane. Buses will be here in like 2 hours, and then we got to take another 3.5 hour. Plus, drive back on buses because it's bad weather. We can't get out. We can't fly out. All of a sudden, Brady comes down the aisle. He's like, hey, we're going into New York tonight, or you can stay on the plane, get on the buses, and go on home. And me and, you know, Paxson or Vrabel just looked at each other like, New York sounds like a better option right now. So we ended up getting off the plane, getting on some taxis or car service, just driving over the city for the night. We had a blast, and then ended up taking a train back in the morning. It's a much better ride than the bus back to New England.
There you go. All right. I do want to give you the chance to promote what you're doing now, which I haven't checked in with you in a while on this, but people out there aren't going to know this. Me and Cope did TV for a while, and then he left me for the Brewers. I don't even know. How do you refer to that? The microbrewery.
Yeah, you were much better on TV than I was. So.
I don't know about that. But
I got to figure a new way. So, we opened up, my partner and I opened up Wine Cider Brewing in East Greenwich, Rhode Island about a year and a half ago. So we're there brewing beer, obviously, with what's going on now. Sort of limiting what we can do, but, you know, I feel like, you know, we can do our part, and with the social spacing, social distancing, and limiting gatherings. So we're still operating with normal hours type thing, but off-premise camp sales and hardware sales. But it's been fun. We're learning a lot, and the beer industry is good, it's a new chapter. You know, you got to find something else to do.
No question. All right. Well, hey, Cope, I always good to catch up with you. I appreciate you coming out, and stay safe, you and your family down there. I appreciate the time.
I appreciate talking with you, and see how this thing plays out here pretty shortly. But it definitely gonna be weird in New England without number 12 in that game.
No question. Thanks, Cope.
All right, buddy.
All right. Thanks to Cope. He's a great dude. Really happy to have him here on the podcast. He was awesome. Don't listen to him. He was awesome on TV. He could have been really good at it. He chose to open the microbrewery and get into that in the end. But yeah, we definitely miss him at NBC, and always a welcome guest here. We're going to jump into the six pack now because, of course, coronavirus has made it a little bit more difficult for us to record the podcast. So we can't do it the way that we've been doing it. We're going to go back to the old school way. One more week, and we'll see how long this lasts, but we're going to do it the way we did it in the days of the six pack, which means I put the call out for questions on Twitter. I ask for questions. You ask me questions. I answer the questions here. If I pick one of yours, you get a little heart on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart emoji, and that's a like, right? Like, so I give you a like on Twitter, and then I answer the question here. Question number one is from NFL Draft Enjoyer at Fan of Nuance. If Indy or lands Rivers or another veteran, does Brissett have a trademark? What is his future? NFL draft enjoyer, I would say that Brissett will likely stay in Indianapolis because they have the cap room to keep him, because quarterback depth is going to be important if you've got a player like Rivers who's older on your roster. You know, they've invested a lot in keeping him, and I think he'd be tough to get real value for based on the fact that he's expensive in 2020. He's only under contract for 1 year, and the quarterback market is sort of flooded right now. And it's weird to say that because, you know, normally quarterbacks are like gold. It's hard to find them. It's hard to get a good one. But if you really look at, you know, the available seats right now, and then you consider the list of available quarterbacks, and it's, you know, it's a pretty big one. You've got Tom Brady available. You've got Cam Newton available. You've got Phillip Rivers, Andy Dalton, Teddy Bridgewater, Jameis Winston. Yeah, I don't know that a quarterback is going to have great value in a trade right now. And so my guess is that the Colts' best option right now, whether it's whether they bring in Phillip Rivers, trade for Nick Foles, would be to keep Jacoby Brissett on board as a depth piece. And it would be expensive to do it, of course. But, I mean, in this case, because they have the cap space to do it, I think you just go ahead and do it. Question number two from Mitesh Patel. That's at MK Patel underscore. Mr. Breer, with the don't call me Mr. With the addition of Fant, does Joe Douglas open number 11 to trade for draft capital or go offensive line, what wide receiver are best available? Mitesh, I still think that his goal is going to be to add to the offensive line. You know, they struck out on Joe Tooney because he was franchised. They struck out on Graham Glasgow. He wound up going to the Broncos. They are sitting there now with George Fant, who I think is a functional tackle, but I still think they're going to be looking to add to that offensive line. So ideally, I think for the Jets, one of the top offensive tackles, whether it's Mekhi Becton, Tristan Wirfs, Jedrick Wills, or Andrew Thomas, one of those guys falls to them, and they draft one there. Those guys have gotten so hot that it's not a sure thing that you get there. And so maybe you trade up for one of them. Maybe if they're all gone, you trade down. But I think the focus remains on the offensive line for Joe Douglas. I was told that he had told people that he was looking to have five new starters on the offensive line. Now, chances are Brian Winters could be back, but he's the only starter left that's under contract. Lots of moving pieces still there. I don't think they're close to done in trying to fix their offensive line. Question number three, this is from Moose Black. That's at Moose underscore Black. What do you expect the league will do for the upcoming draft, reschedule or a call-in draft with nobody attending? I think that the league is going to get creative with it. I think that the league is going to have no fans there because they've already announced that the public event's closed. I don't think they'd even be able to do something in a smaller venue. At this point, you know, the Masters has been canceled and got canceled a few days ago. The Masters is, I believe, 2 weeks before NFL draft weekend or was scheduled to be. And so there's just no way logistically they're going to be able to get the draft. There's no way they would be able to hold a public draft at this point. So I think what you're going to see is some sort of, and I don't know exactly how they do it. And I think, and of course, everything depends on what sort of state we're in as a country when we get to late April. But my guess would be they would probably do some interesting, innovative things with graphics, with sets, with all of that different stuff. I'm fascinated to see how they handle it because, you know, from the league office's standpoint, it's probably the second most important event of the year. The ratings are bonkers for it. You know, it's just like it's too important to the league for them not to do something really, really interesting with it. And so I think there are going to be a lot of people down there on Park Avenue or working remotely now, I guess, that are going to be hard at work at trying to figure out the right way to present it. But I can promise you that whatever they do, they're going to try to make it feel big. Question number four from Funky Donkey. That's at Funky Donkey. Trade price for Yannick Ngakoue. I would say the Jaguars probably would look to get a first-round pick for him. If they can get one, then that would give them three first-round picks because they do have the Rams first-rounder. That's from the Jalen Ramsey trade. Why is he not worth what Frank Clark got last? What the Seahawks got for Frank Clark last year? Well, he's not the run defender that Frank Clark is. And I think, actually, if you look at the players kind of on balance, he may be a little closer to Dee Ford just in the type of player he is than he is to Frank Clark. He's not a very good run defender, and that's the issue. And he's a very, very dynamic pass rusher, but as a run defender, he's not the player that Frank Clark is. And so I think that sort of knocks him down a peg from that value where Frank Clark was, I think, a first rounder and a second rounder. The Jaguars won't be able to get that. But I do think that there might be a team out there that'd be willing to give him a one, especially when you look at how the teams in the Super Bowl were built, and it's a copycat league. You look at how those teams are built, it's through the lines of scrimmage, and it's with a lot of good pass rushers. Question number five from Tyler Schmidt. That's at TeachGeek90. Did the Colts give up too much for Buckner? No, and that's why I sort of left this part out, because I wanted to answer your question, Tyler, when we were doing off the top and the takeaways. Look, part of this for the Colts is finding a way to get blue chip players in the roster. They've had all this cap space for a while now. And part of the problem with having that cap space when you don't have players to spend it on is normally blue chip players aren't the ones who make it to free agency. Those guys get signed by their own teams before they can get to free agency. So normally what you have is players who are out there for a reason. And so that's why Chris Ballard, with all this cap space the last couple of years, has been so judicious in his spending and has looked for finds. Guys like that were bargain guys, like Danico Autry is the best example of it, probably a guy they were able to pluck there. You know, from the Oakland Raiders on the defensive line, has been a very, very good player for him. Another one that I think sort of fits into that category, a corner who, like, I was very much a value signing at the time, Pierre Desir, who had been, you know, I think on the Browns roster, had been with the Seahawks at one point, who really blossomed playing for Frank Reich and playing for that group. Defensively in Indianapolis, Matt Eberflus, of course. And so, like, that's where they'd been, you know, looking for they've been looking for fines with their cap space. How do you get a blue chip player? Well, this was a way to get a blue chip player. They finally got to the point where they felt like there was one out there for him. They had to give up a draft pick for him, but I think they felt like the opportunity to get this sort of player wasn't going to be there in free agency, and DeForest Buckner was better than whatever they were going to get. You know, with the 13th overall pick. So they pull the trigger there and go and get him. I don't think the price was too high to pay. Like, if you ask me, the two best players in the Super Bowl before the fourth quarter were Nick Bosa and DeForest Buckner. So I think he was worth going after. Finally, question number six is from Matt Ramos. I think a habitual listener at Matt_Ramos. What are your thoughts on Mariota going to Las Vegas? Is he competing as a starter or a backup to Carr? He goes in as the backup to Carr. I don't think the situation, as long as it stays the way it is unlike what we saw last year in Tennessee, where Marcus Mariota was on his last legs. Kind of ironic talking about the same player. Marcus Mariota was on his last legs as the franchise quarterback in Tennessee. They wind up giving themselves another option in Ryan Tannehill. Eventually, they've got to pull the plug on Mariota. They go to Tannehill. I think it's the same thing. If John Gruden gets frustrated with Carr, as he has at times over the last 2 years, he has an option now, and he gets a chance to pull the plug. And a guy who is a reclamation project but still has a lot of talent if he can stay healthy. And so I think that's sort of the way you want to look at it. It's a lot like the Tennessee Titans situation last year, which – and look, could be worse. That worked out really well. They wound up in the AFC title game. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we welcome your feedback. We want your feedback. You can get us your feedback on all my social channels, at Albert Breer on Twitter, at Albert R. Breer on Facebook, at Albert_Breer on Instagram. You can hit me up in any of those places. I take the feedback. We'll try to incorporate the feedback. And I appreciate the feedback, of course, this time. At this point, with everything that's going on in our country, we're going to need all the ideas we can get to make the pod an entertaining one for you guys going forward. You should always be listening to all of our podcasts, not just this one, the Monday morning podcast, the Weekside podcast with Jenny and Connor. And of course, on the separate feed, you got the MMQB news podcast, where you can get all of your news in one place, just sort of bite size way to digest the news of the day in the NFL. And there's still a lot of it going on, of course. You can get that feed. You can get the MMQB NFL podcast feed again with my podcast, with the Weekside podcast, with the Monday morning podcast on Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week, I think we'll be there. I'll see you then.